following has been produced by PutThemInASong.com.
My name is Shane Yoder. I write songs for a living. And every day, I hear stories transform into songs. Now you can too. Special episode of The Root Note. I still remember the day at work when I was bored and I looked up podcasts. It was a few years ago, so the first thing that popped up was Serial. I listened to it in, 2 days, and like most people, I wanted more. So I found Truth and Justice. And I don't think me or any of the other listeners that did the same thing, or even Bob and Mike as a matter of fact, really had any idea where it was going to lead. And I bet most of you know who this episode is about. This is the episode about Ed Ains.
I was wondering if you were going to have other people or somebody else sing it, you know, considering it's rap, like you said.
Right. I mean, I don't sound like Tupac. And I wasn't about to try to.
Yeah, but, no. It still sounds good, believe me. But I just wondered, you know, how you sit back and you think, oh, I wonder what he's going to do.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I sound more like, well, I don't know. I don't know what I sound like. But I wanted to say the first few songs I've ever written were rap songs. Me and my friends were really into Eminem and Kid Rock. You know, the essential white boy starter pack with rap.
Right. Call is now being recorded.
Before we get into the song, do you want to explain maybe how you got involved with Truth and Justice?
Well, probably with, like, a lot of people. We all were listening to Serial, and then, you know, the podcast would podcast off of that one. And somehow I just wind up finding the Truth and Justice podcast and stuck with it. I happen to like that one because we can help as listeners, you know, and that just makes that many more people able to help someone. For other ones, you know, they just tell the story and you can listen, and that's cool too, but that's how I got to it from Serial, because I am from Baltimore and Serial intrigued me because, you know, it was from here. So.
Right. Yeah. He got put into the prison there in Cumberland in Western Maryland, and that was 45 minutes from where I grew up.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I quite frankly, I didn't realize there was a high security prison there.
Right. Right. You know, so
cool. Until I heard it on Serial. And I'm like, wait a minute. So when I asked this next question, the mail lady showed up. And my dogs decided to do their best DMX impression. So, I'm sorry about that. What impacted you about Ed Ains' case?
You know, a lot of the other listeners did. We wrote him and he would write back. And I guess that he probably, you know, I would assume that he would probably have a lot of letters to where he wouldn't really, you know, get to know too many people. But, and, you know, everybody has different amounts of time that they can write or whatnot. But, I mean, I did write him and, you know, get the shirts and support, you know, of the people and stuff. But I mean, just his story, you know what I mean? Like, what kind of story, you know? I seen on the Facebook page, what was it, last night? I don't know if you've seen it, where they were saying, like, who would take this story to make it like Hallmark or Lifetime or whatever. Like, it's just that good of a story. It's just not only he was wrongly convicted, you know, his whole family, how the whole thing went, you know. Kim didn't have to wait for him, you know, but God made her wait, you know.
Yeah.
So he had a plan, and it's just, like, it's just crazy.
Ed's case was originally brought to me by a man named Kenny Snow. So it's kind of a broken road type of situation where a woman named Spanesha Rains from Ohio had emailed me and asked me to look at her uncle's case, who was Kenny Snow, the boxer, who we began season 2 talking about. And he was the first case that we took on all on our own. We were, you know, prior to that, we covered a non-Syed, kind of, in conjunction with the Undisclosed podcast and with Serial already laying some groundwork. So as we started covering Kenny Snow's case, part of his story was that he had given false testimony against a man named Ed Eights, which he never told me this. He wrote it in a letter. So if you listen to the beginning of season two of Truth and Justice, I talk about Ed Attez because that's how I read it because I'm an idiot. But, you know, as time went on and we were talking more and more, and I was asking him more about, you know, what happened to him, how he had this deal that went bad. And he kept mentioning that, you know, he doesn't know if Ed Eights is guilty or innocent, but he knows that he lied when he testified against him in order to get his deal. And he suggested that I should reach out to Ed. So after a month or so, I went ahead and wrote a letter to Ed Attez and told him, you know, I was dealing with Kenny Snow, and I'd like to know more about his case. You know, if he could get back with me, I might be able to help. Well, Ed never wrote back for maybe a couple of weeks, and then I decided to just try to write him again. You know, and I kind of changed my approach. I don't remember what I wrote in the second letter, but after he got the second letter, he decided to go ahead and write me back. He pulled the first letter out of the trash can, because that's the one that had my return address on it, because he had crumbled it up and thrown it away, he told me later, because he'd had some bad experiences with people taking money from them, promising him the world and delivering nothing, and he just thought I was another one of those. So he pulls the letter out of the trash can and, you know, uncrumples it and writes me back. And I still remember when he wrote me back, I still have the letter. You know, he says, you're bringing up a lot of bad blood, just mentioning Kenny Snow's name. But, you know, this is what happened in my case. And then, you know, I got to talking to him. I got put on his phone list and he called me and we spoke. And that was episode number 210. And that was the one we titled Hope. And that was the first time we heard from Ed. And I did a full hour long interview with him and he told his story. And basically what happened was his neighbor that lived two doors down from him was found in her home, brutally murdered, nude. The crime scene looked like it was just a brutal beating and killing. And to me, right away, it looked like there's two people here. You know, it looks like maybe she was with someone and then, you know, maybe with a guy and then kind of a jilted lover ex had come in, because there's indicators on the crime scene that made it look like there's two people involved. Well, what happened to Ed was, when the police arrived the next day after they found the body, they spoke with one of Elnora's friends, a woman named Kubia Jackson. And when they spoke with Kubia, she said, I called Elnora last night and she told me I'm sitting here talking to Edward. So they went and talked to Ed and said, why were you with her last night? And he said, I wasn't, because he wasn't. And that started the process rolling that led to his wrongful conviction. They assumed he was lying. My personal theory is that maybe Elnora said, I'm sitting here talking to Leonard and not Edward, or that she lied because, you know, she had told Kubia that she broke up with her boyfriend Leonard, but then it was obvious, we found out later, that she was still seeing him, so she might not have wanted to know. I don't know. So he told him that the police perceived that as being a lie, and they brought him in for questioning. Well, when he went in for questioning, he was sitting there with his mother, and so they asked him where he was the night before, and he told them, I was at my girlfriend Monica's house. They called Monica. She confirmed, yeah, he was here last night. All sounded good. Then they asked him, how did you get there? And this is where things broke bad for Ed, because as he said, I wasn't afraid of the police. I was afraid of my mom. You know, he wasn't worried about the police because he knew he didn't kill anybody. There's nothing tying him to the crime scene, which was later proved. There's not a single one of his fingerprints, hairs, blood, semen, DNA, anything indicating he was ever in that trailer. So he wasn't worried about the police. But he had taken his grandmother's car without her permission to go visit Monica. He wasn't supposed to do that. His mom was in the room with him. And so he said, she came and picked me up. And then, of course, they go ask Monica how Ed get there. And Monica said that he just showed up. And he said Monica gave him a ride. She said, no, he didn't. And that got the wheels turning, where they just, at that point, the detectives just had blinders on. The district attorney was involved right from the very beginning. Earlier than I've ever seen in a case, before they even filed charges, and they started building a case against Ed. When all of the forensics came back, they determined that there was no evidence of him being there. There were fingerprints on the crime scene that weren't his. There was semen on the crime scene that wasn't his. There were hairs on the crime scene that weren't his. But it was too late, because they hadn't, and that night they interviewed him, they had actually had him strip his clothes off and look for any scratches or bruises or cuts or anything like that, and he had nothing on him. But they didn't do that with any other suspects because they already had their mind made up that it must have been him. And that led to, you know, the whole process was 5 years long. A few years go by. He goes to trial. When he goes to trial, the first time there's a mistrial. There was a hung jury. They tried him again, and it wasn't until 5 years after the crime when he was actually convicted and sentenced to 99 years in prison. But during that 5 years, you know, Ed lived his life. He met a woman named Kim Miller, who he then married. Kim Ates now, and they had a daughter named Kyra. He had went to school to become a truck driver. He was driving a truck. They had bought a new house. Kim was pregnant with her second child, Zachary, when he went back to trial and he got convicted. And so he was actually sent away to prison for the rest of his life while his wife was still pregnant with her second child.
You said when you were first looking over the case that two people were involved. Is that what drew you into investigating Ed's case?
It was, because right away the prosecution's narrative didn't connect with me. It wasn't congruent with what I was seeing on the crime scene. You know, without getting into too much specifics, you had a lot of indicators that, you know, Elnora was only 4'1" tall, I think, maybe 4'4". She was a tiny, tiny little woman. Ed Ates, on the other hand, is 6'7", 300 pounds. He's huge. Well, there was these indicators that she was strangled in the bedroom of the house, which is the same place where the semen stain was found and some other items. But then you could tell by the crime scene that she had broken free, that she got loose, went to the front door. I mean, she was choked, I think, nearly to death in the bedroom. And you could see where she had broken free. She got to the front door. She pulled the curtains off the front door trying to escape. And then she was caught again. And then ultimately her throat was slit and she sadly passed away there, right there in the living room. But the big question was, how does a 4'1" woman escape the grasp of 6'7", 300-pound Ed? Or how does she escape the grasp of any one person? And the only thing that made sense to me was someone had to have helped her. There had to have been someone else in the room, and then given the other circumstances, her being nude, and the fact that there was a semen stain on the comforter, there was obviously indicators that she was having relations with someone in that bedroom when this all went down. And so it made sense to me, maybe the jilted lover comes in and is attacking her and whoever she was with fought them off, because that's the only way I could figure that she broke free. But none of that, I couldn't come up with a scenario that equaled 6'7", 300-pound Ed Ates with no motive and a girlfriend down the road, why he would have been involved in any of that. None of it made sense.
Goodbye, family. Goodbye, friends. I could use a visit every now and then. Yeah, I messed up. I told a lie. But strangers tell them better when their job's on the line. If I say I'm a guilty man, I'll just be lying again. Hello, prison. Hello, guards. Please don't take offense when I curse behind your walls, 'cause I'll be here for 99. Yeah, I could take their plea deal, but I don't wanna be that guy. If I say I'm a guilty man, I'd just be lying again. The irony about it is overwhelming me. They took it all away, but my innocence they let me keep. Hello, justice, and hello, hope. All your belief in me means more than you know. Here's my chance to make parole. Because of you, they set me free, and now I'm headed home. They said if you're a guilty man, took it all away. My innocence, they let me keep.
Truth and Justice and the listeners engaging in Ed's case, I believe, made all the difference in the world because, and not just me, but everyone together. You know, it was the whole concept behind Truth and Justice is it's a crowdsourced approach. It's ordinary people from around the world giving whatever they can of themselves, whether it's money or skills or time or just anything, any way they can help, or putting us in connection with people. And one of our listeners had a personal relationship with Mike Ware, who's the executive director of the Innocence Project of Texas. They put us in contact with Mike. Mike took my call based solely on the fact, because I'm just this random podcaster guy from Michigan. And I talked to him about the case, and he heard me out, told me he needs documents, trial transcripts, things like that. We went and got those, came back. I had listeners helping me with a lot of the stuff. And so the first step was pitching that case to Mike. And then Mike decided that they were going to take the case. And so that's when they assigned Allison Clayton to Ed's case. Another big impact that Truth and Justice had was reconnecting Ed with his family. After he had exhausted his final appeal and knew he was going to die in prison, there was no way he was ever getting out. Ed had told his wife, Kim, to just divorce him. He told her that, you know, he needed her to move on and create a new life for herself. And she had walked away at his request. And it had been, she still brought the kids like on Father's Day. But when I met Ed, he didn't even know if he was still married. He didn't know how to work the phones because he hadn't made a phone call in almost 2 years. He hadn't had a piece of mail, no letters, no nothing in years. And then you know, through the podcast, I connected with Kim. I explained to her what I was doing. And having someone that wasn't family fighting for Ed and believing in his innocence and telling her that there's a chance we might be able to get him to come home. She turns out she never did follow through with the divorce. She could never bring herself to do it. She reconnected with Ed. And then for the next 2 years, Kim and Zach and Kyra, Ed's two kids, started visiting Ed regularly. They started talking on the phone almost every night, visiting him every single weekend. And that ultimately played a big role in his release from prison because you know, when the parole board began to evaluate his file, one of the first things they do is look at your visitor list and see, do you have anybody to go home to? And in Ed's case, it was very clear that he did. But listeners helped us with everything from investigating the crime scene photos, pitching theories, to we have listeners that were serologists that looked at DNA evidence. We had listeners that put us in contact with people. We had photogrammetry experts. We had listeners that were willing to buy us a vehicle in order to compare to crime scene photos. We had John Cryer, who came on the show and was a listener and helped us track down a certain time when Unsolved Mysteries aired back in 1993. You know, so we had all of this help and then writing to Ed and keeping his spirits up. And then ultimately, Allison Clayton, Ed's attorney, when Ed was coming up for parole, to my knowledge and according to his final parole attorney, Roger Nichols, no inmate in the state of Texas has ever been released on parole with murder charges without admitting guilt. And Ed would never do that. He said he would rather die in prison than to say that he killed Elnora Griffin because he didn't do it. And Allison reached out to a very, very good parole attorney, a guy named Roger Nichols, and convinced him to take the case for free, pro bono. And Roger then picked up the ball and intervened into the parole board. And as he put it, the parole board system in Texas is kind of a conveyor belt where they just kind of come down one after another, and Roger, as he put it, made a stop the belt, take Ed's case and actually look at it. And that's what they did. The parole board, the voters actually looked at Ed's case and they saw the merit in his actual innocence, and it caused one of them to do something they never do, which was to leave and actually go to the prison to visit Ed to talk to him about his case. And within 48 hours, they voted to parole Ed, and as of right now, he's sitting at home with his family.
When we all found out about Ed getting parole, it was the episode 329, I believe, 18. And when you did your song, Lying Again, I think it was at the end mm-hmm. of that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we all found out about him getting parole. And I guess throughout the, looking on the page and throughout people's comments and through, you know, my own ideas or whatever, I thought, you know, it would be a good memorial kind of thing to do for him since his mom did pass away, you know, and didn't get to see him get out. And just because that she had that much faith in him, you know, and that he would get out. And but she just didn't make it that extra little bit of time to actually see it.
What were your thoughts? Like, you're sitting there, you had a lot of time to think and talk to people. What did you expect?
I didn't really know what to expect. It was an extremely emotional day. You know, we all got there. We thought he was going to get out around 10 o'clock in the morning, and everybody showed up around 8. And, you know, every time, you know, there was a big crowd there before I got there. When I showed up, there's, you know, big cheers. And then Allison Clayton and her students show up, and there's more big cheers. And Roger Nichols shows up, and there's more big cheers. And then Ed's wife Kim and the kids shows up, and there's a lot of cheers and a lot of tears, a lot of hugging. I mean, everybody just couldn't believe it was about to happen, that he was actually going to come home. So emotional, so much love filling that entire crowd of people there, just waiting for Ed to come out. But then it just kept dragging and dragging and dragging. It ended up being about 5 hours we waited. And so there was definitely a dip down in the energy level at some point. And you know what's going to happen, and you know he's going to come out anytime, but you still, you know, you have that little piece of you that's like, is this ever really going to happen? Like, because the whole thing seems surreal anyway, that he's coming out. And then the longer it took, the more you, kind of spirit started to dip. And of course, everybody's, you know, dying of thirst and hungry. And but then, you know, the Truth and Justice listeners again, you know, people were doing Facebook Live videos here and there, you know, with everybody waiting. And they caught that everyone was starving while they were sitting there waiting for all these hours. And next thing we know, I think while we were there, we had a total of 14 pizzas and about 10 2 liters of soda get delivered that listeners just from around the country all pitched in together and sent us pizza to feed everybody. And it just, you know, it's a small thing, but it's not. I mean, it's such a powerful thing to know that the whole idea is it doesn't take one person doing a lot. It takes a lot of people doing a little. And that's what we see everything from, you know, whether it's donating time or the $35,000 that were donated to the family, or just making sure there's pizza there and everybody stays fed to keep their spirits up while we're waiting for them to walk out.
Right. Well, support in any kind of aspect of life is not a small thing. You know, it holds up something. It, mm-hmm. You know, right now I'm looking out a window and seeing a much larger tree fell on a smaller tree, and it's just sitting there. You know, it's supporting that tree.
Mm-hmm.
And even small things can support a larger aspect of life. You know, it's, well, I don't know what I'm talking about. I was trying to match your mood and trying to, I should just write stuff down.
you were doing great. The tree analogy was awesome.
Maybe I'll have your awesome metaphor crew refine that a little bit.
The thing about the wind, Shane.
Or at least, yeah, the wind. What did he talk about while he was eating ribs for the first time in years? Like, just trying to get into that mindset of freedom. You know what I mean? Like, what do you talk about?
You know, I think for Ed, and for me too, it was about trying to feel normal. You know, and when we ate ribs, there was a big crowd there. But, you know, that moment you were talking about where it was just me and him, and we were prepping the ribs, and we were putting a dry rub on the ribs the night before. And that's the first time we had a chance where it was just me and Ed together. And that was probably one of my favorite moments, if not my favorite moment of the entire, you know, 3 or 4 days I got to spend with him. Because it was a couple of buddies hanging out at his house, you know, just like if you had your best friend over to, you know, to grill something or whatever. And we weren't talking about prison or the release or how do you feel. We were just talking about everything from, you know, what makes a good rub and, you know, making sure we balance our cayenne pepper and brown sugar ratio in the rub that we were putting together. But you know, then he opened up a little bit about just things he was feeling, that, you know, how crazy it was for him to walk through Walmart and just look at all the things. You know, he and I went to Walmart at one point to go get some supplies, and he looked around and just said, you know, it's just crazy to see all this stuff at your fingertips that you can have. If you just, with just money, you can have it. And it's just all, for me, it was just impacting me, like how grateful he was for all these little things in life, and in a realization of the things that we take for granted. And, you know, he's been through more than any of us hopefully will ever go through in our lives. And, you know, and he's got a tough road ahead of him. You know, he's got an ankle monitor, and he's got to track all of his movements, and he's got a lot of restrictions, but his attitude is just incredibly positive. I mean, everything, to say don't sweat the small stuff is an understatement for him. Just everything just kind of, he just lets it fall off his shoulders and just keeps driving forward. And, you know, he's just so happy to be home with his wife and kids, you know, and little things. Like every time I came to his house, he wanted to make me a cup of coffee because he's just, he loves the Keurig machine, you know, after all those years in prison. you know, and just cooking up the ribs. And when we ate him, it was just, but it's not, I know it's probably not really answering the question, but there wasn't a lot of just talking about, you know, what it was like to be home and things like that. The way I read Ed, the feeling I got from Ed when we were there is he's so happy to be home and with his family. He is ready to be a dad and a husband. You know, while I was there, I helped him hang up a TV stand on the wall to hang their TV up, and he hung up a key holder and was cleaning out the backyard and, you know, waking the kids up in the morning just because he just missed them 5:30 in the morning going into Zachary's room. He said that first morning, 5:30 a.m., he opened the door and said, "Hey, man, what you doing? What you up to?" And just woke everybody up. He's just ready to do all that. But then I think he just wants to feel normal, you know, and just hanging out with friends and family and doing normal things. Because there's not a lot of normal, you know, in those first few days because, you know, there's crowds, you know, his family coming over and, you know, then, you know, I'm bringing crowds in. We got people with cameras and there's all this stuff happening. But it was those quiet moments where he just got to be normal that I saw Ed the happiest, I think.
So I thought, well, you know, let's try to make this kind of like a something that celebrates his release, but also memorializes her, and lets a kind of her a little bit. Kind of allows her to celebrate too, even though she's not here. You know what I mean? Like, just with her voice being in it. This way, I think what she passed away maybe in August, I don't remember. Or maybe April, I can't remember the exact time, but whenever the time of that year comes up, you know, he could have something if he wanted to, just to hear her, you know? Yeah. So that's what I thought originally. And then I went from there and asked a couple people, you know, on a Facebook page that I know from over the years, you know, what they thought, if it was a good idea or whatever. So I went from there, and then I actually asked Kim, you know, what type of songs and stuff that Ed liked. And she gave, or artists as well. And she told me a few of them. And then I just went from there and just, I think she said R. Kelly and Tupac, and because it was, you know, pertaining to his mom, I think that's why I went with the Dear Mama Tupac one, because I wanted it to be, I knew you couldn't actually use the, you know, his stuff, but I wanted him to recognize what it was at least, right. Even the words were changed. And somehow we had to do that and still be able to fit what Margie said in there, you know, because we only have certain words from interviews. It was kind of hard to do all that. That whole song is like just great in itself. you know, just because of, you know, he's talking about his own experiences, and it's just so real, you know? It's not something made up and, oh,
right,
in the fairy tale land, you know what I mean?
We wrote the second verse first, and it's about having four walls around him and what each one represents. And it leads into one of my favorite line in the song. That's the truth. Don't doubt it. Cause now I'm medical precision critical about it.
Yep.
That gives me chills every time I listen to it.
It's funny cause when me and you both, I just got chills too. Even though the whole song is for Ed, I mean, it's still a memorial for their mom. So what I went ahead and did at the end was, once, you know, you finished the stuff and sent it to me, I downloaded it, or burnt it, however you want to call it, to a CD. And the Lying Again song, I went to your website and just bought it and put that on one CD and sent it to Ed. That way he'll have that if and when he ever wants to listen to it. But because it was a memorial for their mom, I also sent it to Kelvin as well. It doesn't, the song itself doesn't pertain to him, but I figured he could hear his mom too when he wanted, you know? So, I'm hoping that he liked it. I don't know if he did or if he didn't, or even if he heard it yet.
Let me tell you about me. I'm what I call myself. I'm a real damn woman. I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah, I know, mama, you would never lie. Believe me, the truth talk can be difficult for some minds, but you never had a reason to hide, cause you were a real damn woman with three kids by your side. When we got sick, you protected us, and even through the pain, never rejected us.
Now I'm gonna say this proudly, okay? I did the same thing to myself and my children. I don't play that shit.
I know it was hard raising a man, but a woman like you did all that you can. I know it might be an understatement, but dear mama, you are appreciated.
So Ed would cut my yard and come to visit. You know, yeah, he drove one of my cars.
Every day I ask myself, what would mama do? You knew the truth, and you did all that you could do. And I bet you won't be fighting until all this is behind me, but I think I've got to hear it from you.
My name is Marcia Duze Jackson. I know my baby is coming home.
You gave me all the strength, all the peace of mind, but all the pain every day took a piece of mine. And I look from you to take it one day at a time. But dear mama, there's something weighing on my mind. I hope you understand. I never meant to hurt you, it was out of my hands. And even though it wasn't my fault, I admit, ever since there's been four walls I've been struggling with. The one to my left, yeah, that's regret. I've been seeing every face I've ever heard in every brick. To the right wall, I feel small, cause I've got every day a lost hope scratched in it. The one behind me, mama, I don't even look at. It reminds me of the drama I was never good at. I try to keep it all behind me, like you taught me. But this bottle of karma I push aside has gone bad. The wall in front of me, man, it's the hardest. I face it every day like a plague, cause it's always where my heart is. The sound of that key took a freedom, took the life of me and then some. When they locked me up, no, they fucked me up. And all that anger grew like cancer when I thought of it. My dear mama, that's the truth, don't doubt it. Cause now I'm medical precision critical about it. And I wanna shout it just like mom would have it, cause I'm her apple. And now we got this whole damn tree surrounded. I'm homebound and grounded, in your house I found it. I'm so proud to have it, can you hear the trumpet sounding? Dear mama,
my name is Marcia Duze Jackson. I know my baby is coming home.
Bob, let me ask you this question. Who did it?
Oh, damn. On the root note? We're going to talk about who did it on the root note?
I just wanted to ask you the question. You are in my court.
That's right. I'm in your dojo. I can't tell you.
I don't have to put this on.
No, that's all right. You can play with me joking around about it. That's fine. I can't tell you who did it. I think that this is the best I can do for you. Throughout the season on Ed's case, we took the extremely deep dive into all of the evidence and all of the circumstances surrounding it. And, you know, that led me to a theory that I closed the season with. And it goes back to what I had said earlier, that I think that this was a lover's triangle, and this was a jilted lover that interrupted something between Elnora and her boyfriend. I think that when we finish developing all the evidence that we've continued to gather while we're continuing to work on his case, I think that before too long we're going to prove it.
The Root Note has been brought to you by Put Them in a Song in collaboration with MBI Studios. All guests know they are being recorded and are willing to be. All music and songs are created and scored by PutThemInASong.com. You can follow the Root Note podcast at Root Note Pod on Twitter. If you would like to have a song or music created for you or a loved one, visit PutThemInASong.com, where you have a better voice than you think. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Root Note.